no one who knows and admires Neil's trilogy, Being Alive, Staying Alive and Being Human, will be surprised that he's inedited another brilliant anthology here in The Hundred Years' War. As in the trilogy, he employs the breadth of his, and the amazing breadth of his, reading and knowledge of poetry to provide a world perspective. And this being the centenary of the start of the First World War, there is no shortage of excellent anthologies of English language poetry. Go to the bookshop down the road and you'll see them. Wilfred Owen, Siegfried Sassoon, Isaac Rosenberg, David Jones, Edward Thomas, all are represented here, as are Ivor Gurney, Charles Sawley, and Edward Blunden. But this anthology is different. It has poets not just from the first two world wars, but from every single conflict, or almost every conflict, of the past 100 years. Spain, Korea, Vietnam, Ireland, Iraq, Iran again and again, Yugoslavia, the Falklands, Sudan, Palestine, Israel, Afghanistan, right up to date now in Syria. What a terrible litany that is. These poems are seen from all viewpoints, from that of the combatants, civilians, victims, journalists, by poets, and those by who've never written poetry before. They express not only Wilfred Owen's war and the pity of war, but the courage, the cowardice, sometimes the boredom and the fear always of war. All a poet can do is warn, wrote Owen, and these poets, these poems, do that. We'll start with World War I. 37 million people died. Alfred Lichtenstein was a son of a Prussian Jewish factory owner. He completed compulsory military training as the war began and was posted to the Western Front. He was wounded in the Battle of Somme and he died from his wounds. Michael.
Leaving for the front. Before dying, I must just make my poem. Quiet, comrades, don't disturb me. We're going off to war. Death is our bond. Oh, if only my girlfriend would stop howling. What do I matter? I'm happy to go. My mother's crying. You need to be made of iron. The sun is falling down onto the horizon. Soon they'll be throwing me into a nice mass grave. In the sky, the good old sunset is glowing red. In 13 days, maybe I'll be dead.
Wilhelm Klemm was a field surgeon in Van Huysen's Third Army in the First Battle of the Marne. After the war, he set up a publishing house, but that was destroyed by Allied bombing in the next World War, a war in which his two sons were also killed.
Clearing station. Straw rustling everywhere. The candle stumps stand there staring solemnly. Across the nocturnal vault of the church, moans go drifting and choking words. There's a stench of blood, pus, shit and sweat. Bandages ooze away underneath torn uniforms. Clammy, trembling hands and wasted faces. Bodies stay propped up as their dying heads slump down. In the distance, the battle thunders grimly on, day and night, groaning and grumbling non-stop. And to the dying men patiently waiting for their graves, it sounds for all the world like the words of God.
Cécile Perrin was a French poet. She made a collection of poems, Les Captifs Poèmes, 1914, I can't do the date, I'm afraid, 1914 to 1918, and she survived the war. Harriet.
Wartime April. The north wind whistling round the doors. Snow filling the lanes and tracks with white. Wartime April. April caught and pinioned with the gale's lash. April of the stricken light. The women wear black veils. The girls a grown-up dignity. The talk is in murmurs. Night closes in. Silence. A splinter of hope gleams in the dark like driftwood. Here we sit. No one speaking now. What do you say to a woman crying? Here we sit, like prisoners, never stirring, each in her house. We sit and know the men are dying.
You don't need me to tell you much about Wilfred Owen, but just to remind you, he was sent to Craig Lockhart War Hospital in 1917, suffering from shell shock from the 4 months that he spent in frontline trenches, and it was at Craig Lockhart that he met Siegfried Sassoon. He was killed, aged 25, a week before the armistice was signed. Michael.
Anthem for doomed youth. What passing bells for these who die as cattle? Only the monstrous anger of the guns. Only the stuttering rifles' rapid rattle can patter out their hasty orisons. No mockeries now for them, no prayers nor bells, nor any voice of mourning save the choirs, the shrill, demented choirs of wailing shells and bugles calling for them from sad shires. What candles may be held to speed them all? Not in the hands of boys, but in their eyes, shall shine the holy glimmers of goodbyes. The pallor of girls' brows shall be their pall. Their flowers, the tenderness of patient minds, and each slow dusk, a drawing down of blinds.
Neil has unearthed some writers and poets that I had never heard of, and this next one, François Pochet, was absolutely new to me, and I suspect him new to most of you. He served on the Isère front in 1914, contracted pneumonia, was bedridden for 2 years, during which he wrote 2 volumes of poetry. And this, which is going to follow, is an extract from Les Commandements du Destin, which spanned the whole war. And in that, in the same way that Herbert Read's The End of the War spanned the following war, and David Jones's In Parenthesis.
The day before. It will soon be 2 years that they have been hanging on to the woods, the abandoned walls, and the fields lying fallow, oozing into the soil like some sullied spring. They grope around, searching for a narrow fissure that could open the way for their vast flood. But we mirror their course of action, expose their plot, and so long as we are aware of every step they make, we return their ungodly patience against them. The space between the 2 camps is pitted with craters. Behind a low clump of bristling things, our trenches and theirs form thin black lines like screwed-up eyelids. Nothing can distract these long vertical eyes from their resolute vigilance. Each gaze that dies in the darkness of the target gives way to a fresh gaze. When the grass on one side thinks up a surprise, the grass opposite becomes suspicious. At times, hardly more than a grey cap glimpsed through the bushes. Less frequently, a sad song wafts up, unknown words floating, a hostile dream to ours. Everything is numbered and classified, thicket, open ground. Everything has its destiny marked on the sights of a weapon. Each moment prepares for the moment that will follow, a ghastly awakening. The sun is already sinking over the horizon. We demand their life. They demand ours. This craving is all we have in common. Nothing else.
People came into these wars from an extraordinary variety of backgrounds. And the next writer, Henri Jacques, a Frenchman, had been a sailor on masted merchantmen before joining the 25th Infantry Regiment in 1914. He was wounded twice in the Battle of the Somme in 1915 and 1916 and was then invalided out in 1917. Extraordinarily brave man, he was awarded the Croix de Guerre and the Légion d'Honneur, and George V presented him with the English Military Medal. So a remarkable man.
Dead men with masks. The plain where men kill, die and suffer is as yellow as a vat of sulphur. The wind still stirs a poisonous smell and green clouds float on the horizon. Gas roams around in the trenches, spreading spasms and suffocation as it searches for human agony. On reddish grass and under dead thistles, bodies lying motionless on their back or bellies. No one could name them, not even their mothers. Beneath the glass plate, their eyes are all the same. Their faces are screwed up in the same way. Masks frozen in silent and prolonged laughter. Impossible to say how handsome or plain they were. Under the weird hood, sometimes stained with red blood, they look like puppets exhausted from their exertions. With their big round eyes and their bird-like profile, spectres of the monstrous carnival of war. With a crude piece of rag, fate has moulded 100 times the same head above 100 bodies. As if all these lads were but a single corpse.
The next poet you will know again, Isaac Rosenberg, but to remind you, he was a son of Jewish immigrants. He was an apprentice engraver, so talented that he got into the Slade Art School, which was a hard thing for a working-class boy to do. He hated Rupert Brooke's what he called beglorious sonnets, and he hated war, but amazingly he enlisted and voluntarily in the Suffolk Regiment for the most bizarre reason, in order to help his family financially. That shows how very poor they were. He went to France, where all his poems were written, and he was killed returning from night patrol at dawn on April the 1st, 1918, near Arras.
Louse hunting. Nudes, stark and glistening, yelling in lurid glee. Grinning faces and raging limbs whirl over the floor one fire. For a shirt verminously busy, yon soldier tore from his throat, with oaths Godhead might shrink at, but not the lice. And soon the shirt was a flare over the candle he'd lit while we lay. Then we all sprang up and stripped to hunt the verminous brood. Soon, like a demon's pantomime, the place was raging. See the silhouettes agape, see the gibbering shadows mixed with the battled arms on the wall. See gargantuan hooked fingers pluck in supreme flesh to smutch supreme littleness. See the merry limbs in hot highland fling, because some wizard vermin charm from the quiet this revel, when our eyes were half lulled by the dark music blown from sleep's trumpet.
In the French army, André Martel had the similar problem with louse. He survived the war, however, and he became secretary to the artist Jean Dubuffet. Harriet.
Execution. Itching all night long, it's never ended. Stem the evil of the scratch. In a shirt seam where they hatch, one of the scoundrels is apprehended. The time has come. Let justice be enacted in all its rigour, with all speed, against such unrepentant greed. Humanity has suddenly reacted. Louse, your bliss was brief as mayfly's breath. The verdict's quick. No pity is expressed. The perpetrator is condemned to death, and fingernail to fingernail is pressed. A bit like us, as the war grinds on. One sharp crack, you're gone.
Enough of the First World War, on to the Spanish Civil War, where 500,000 people died. Antonio Machado wrote this poem a few days after the wonderful poet Lorca was executed. Machado fled to France, where he died in 1939.
The crime was in Granada. One, the crime. He was seen walking between rifles down a long street and going out to the cold countryside, still with stars of early dawn. They killed Federico when light came. The squad of executioners didn't dare look him in the face. They all closed their eyes. They prayed, "Not God can save you." Dead fell Federico, blood on his forehead and lead in his stomach, that the crime was in Granada. Know it, poor Granada, in his Granada. Two, the poet and death. He was seen walking alone with her, not afraid of her scythe. The sun already on tower and tower, the hammers on the anvil, anvil and anvil of the forges. Federico was speaking, flirting with death. She listened. "Companion, because yesterday in my verse the clapping of your dry palms resounded, and you gave ice to my song, an edge of your sickle of silver to my tragedy, I will sing you your missing flesh, the eyes you lack, your hair the wind was ruffling, the red lips where they kissed you. Today as yesterday, gypsy, my death, how good alone with you in these breezes of Granada, my Granada." Three, he was seen walking. Friends carve a tomb of stone and dream in the Alhambra for the poet, over a fountain where the water weeps and forever says, "The crime was in Granada, in his Granada."
On to World War II, in which 78 million people died. That was 2.5% of the then population of the world, and 68% of those deaths were civilian. W.H. Auden had already moved to the United States in January 1939, and he watched from a distance Europe move inexorably towards the war.
Epitaph on a Tyrant. Perfection of a kind was what he was after, and the poetry he invented was easy to understand. He knew human folly like the back of his hand, and was greatly interested in armies and fleets. When he laughed, respectable senators burst with laughter, and when he cried, the little children died in the streets.
Many people think that Alan Lewis was the best poet of the Second World War. He was originally a pacifist. He joined up in March 1940, horrified by what he saw Hitler doing. And he wrote this poem in tribute to Edward Thomas after a visit to the Hampshire village of Steep and Sheet, which Thomas loved so much. The reference to the shoulder of mutton in the poet is as a nearby hill, as probably many of you know. And in the last line, "the bullet stopped his song," anticipated Lewis's own death. He was shot accidentally by a pistol in Burma in 1944, Harriet.
All day it has rained. All day it has rained, and we on the edge of the moors have sprawled in our bell tents, moody and dull as boors. Ground sheets and blankets spread on the muddy ground, and from the first grey wakening we have found no refuge from the skirmishing fine rain and the wind that made the canvas heave and flap and the taut wet guy ropes ravel out and snap. All day the rain has glided, wave and mist and dream, drenching the gorse and heather, a gossamer stream, too light to stir the acorns that suddenly, snatched from their cups by the wild southwesterly, pattered against the tent and our upturned, dreaming faces. And we stretched out, unbuttoning our braces, smoking a woodbine, darning dirty socks, reading the Sunday papers. I saw a fox and mentioned it in the note I scribbled home. And we talked of girls and dropping bombs on Rome, and thought of the quiet dead and the loud celebrities exhorting us to slaughter and the herded refugees, yet thought softly, morosely of them, and as indifferently as of ourselves, or those whom we for years have loved and will again. Tomorrow may be love, but now it is the rain, possesses us entirely, the twilight and the rain. And I can remember nothing dearer or more to my heart than the children I watched in the woods on Saturday, shaking down burning chestnuts for the schoolyard's merry play, or the shaggy, patient dog who followed me by sheet and steep and up the wooded scree to the shoulder of mutton where Edward Thomas brooded long on death and beauty till a bullet stopped his song.
That horrific carnage of civilians was considerably caused by bombing from both sides. The Luftwaffe bombed London and Coventry and Liverpool and many others at Portsmouth. And Bomber Harris bombed Dresden and other German cities. And together they accounted for 50 million civilian deaths. Harriet.
I remember. It was my bridal night, I remember. An old man of 73. I lay with my young bride in my arms, a girl with TB. It was wartime, and overheard and overhead, the Germans were making a particularly heavy raid on Hampstead. What rendered the confusion worse, perversely, our bombers had chosen that moment to set out for Germany. Harry, do they ever collide? I do not think it has ever happened. Oh, my bride. My bride.
I should have pointed out that that was, rather surprisingly, Stephen Smith, who wrote 101 Dalmatians. Dylan Thomas also was a civilian throughout the war, and he'd moved up to London from South Wales and therefore observed the Blitz.
A refusal to mourn the death by fire of a child in London. Never until the mankind making, bird, beast, and flower fathering, and all humbling darkness, tells with silence the last light breaking, and the still hour is come of the sea tumbling in harness, and I must enter again the round Zion of the water bead, and the synagogue of the ear of corn, shall I let pray the shadow of a sound, or sow my salt seed in the least valley of sackcloth to mourn the majesty and burning of the child's death. I shall not murder the mankind of her going with a grave truth, nor blaspheme down the stations of the breath with any further elegy of innocence and youth. Deep with the first dead lies London's daughter, robed in the long friends, the grains beyond age, the dark veins of her mother, secret by the unmourning water of the riding Thames. After the first death, there is no other.
Of course, the war wasn't confined purely to Europe and to England and Germany. And Japan, here is a Japanese poet, Mitsushiro Kaneko, and he wrote anti-war poetry, but he was unable to get it published during the war in Japan. Harry.
Ascension. Today is execution day for the pacifists, escaping from the gunfire as their corpses topple. Their souls have ascended to heaven to proclaim injustice and iniquity. In grief, their spirits have begun to relent, calling from the edge of a great four-cornered ice floe, turning to a rainbow flickering in the dark. Bombs have exploded, fireworks have crackled. Their souls, sent drifting to one corner of heaven, turned into mist, into spume, into cloud drifts, to stain the sky with blood that is still hot.
I said that Alan Lewis was considered by many to be the best, anyway, English poet of the Second World War, but many people will give that credit to Keith Douglas, who joined up in 1939 and was posted to Cairo and Palestine the following year, or 1941, and fought in the North African campaign. Finding himself inactive in the Second Battle of El Alamein, in October 41, he took the initiative and he drove to the front and was made a tank commander and took part in the sweep through North Africa. It's an extraordinary thing to do, isn't it? He was killed by enemy mortar fire later in the war during the Normandy invasion in June 1944. Michael.
Vergiss mein nicht. 3 weeks gone, and the combatants gone, returning over the nightmare ground, we found the place again, and found the soldiers sprawling in the sun, the frowning barrel of his gun overshadowing. As we came on that day, he hit my tank with one like the entry of a demon. Look, here in the gunpit's spoil, the dishonored picture of his girl, who has put Steffi, Vergiss mein nicht, in a copybook Gothic script. We see him almost with content, abased, and seeming to have paid and mocked at by his own equipment that's hard and good when he's decayed. But she would weep to see today how on his skin the swart flies move, the dust upon the paper eye, and the burst stomach like a cave. For here the lover and killer are mingled, who had one body and one heart. And death, who had the soldier singled, has done the lover mortal hurt.
Anna Swier was a Polish dramatist before the war. She joined the resistance and became a military nurse during the Warsaw Uprising in 1944. Here is her poem, He Was Lucky. She indeed was lucky. She was within 1 hour of being executed and then was amazingly reprieved. Harriet.
He was lucky. The old man leaves his house, carries books. A German soldier snatches his books, flings them in the mud. The old man picks them up. The soldier hits him in the face. The old man falls. The soldier kicks him and walks away. The old man lies in the mud and blood. Under him, he feels the books.
And of course, Hungary suffered enormously in the Second World War. Here is the writer András Meze. He is writing about the suffering in Hungary. 500,000 Hungarian Jews, Roma, homosexuals, and political dissidents were transported to death camps in Poland and Austria. Nearly three quarters of Hungary's Jewish population died. Metze himself survived, and these poems were translated by Thomas Ozak Lunt, himself a survivor of the Holocaust.
From Christmas in Auschwitz. Robbery, naked. "You won't be needing these," he said, and flung my mother's photograph among his booty and my shirt. I still retained, heaped on my blanket, the things I had to bring. A mess tin, my boots and socks, warm underclothes, a bar of shaving soap. And I had that irremovable mark on my finger in the place of my looted wedding ring.
Jason. She carefully unlaced her grandmother's boots, then kicked off her own. Before the pair, the river. Behind them, Jason, the neighbour's son from the square, lit by the frozen snow, and his machine gun. Jason, discharging his first ever magazine. Jason, standing stunned as the tumbling bodies are whisked away and gone with the turbulent current. Had he done that? Was there so little to life?
Gustav. Feinstein, a Jew from Memel, recognized his neighbor in the execution squad. And he cried out to him, "Gustav, aim straight between the eyes."
Towards the Dniester. As the marchers dragged themselves forward, the barefooted peasants by the road picked out the choicest boots and trousers, and at their bidding, the guards shot down the occasional well-clad prisoner in exchange for a handful of notes. The death march stumbled on towards Orhai. The peasants collected their wares.
Bertolt Brecht went into exile first in Denmark, then in Sweden, then in Finland, and finally ending up in the United States in 1937, the year that he wrote a German war primer, which was published in Moscow. Michael.
War has been brought into disrepute. I hear it is being said in respectable circles that from the moral point of view, the Second World War did not come up to the First. The Wehrmacht is said to deplore the means by which the SS effected the extermination of certain peoples. In the Ruhr, it seems, the captains of industry regret the bloody razzias that filled their mines and factories with slaves. The intelligentsia, so I hear, condemn the industrialist demand for such slave workers and their shabby treatment. Even the bishops are distancing themselves from this way of waging war. In short, on all sides, there is a feeling that unfortunately the Nazis have done us a disservice, and that war, of itself a natural and necessary thing, by being conducted on this occasion in so heedless and indeed inhuman a fashion, has been and will be for quite some time discredited.
Wonderful. Forward to the 1960s and Vietnam, where between 1 and 3.8 million people died. Phan Ho was born into a Confucian family. He became an activist against the French, and he moved to North Vietnam and helped found the Vietnamese Writers Association. Harriet.
Beautiful and loving days gone by. I shot him. The beautiful and loving days gone by could not stop me. Perhaps he had forgotten those days, but I remember still the rice fields of my village, the endless sea of rice. the morning dew like pearls on the sides of the road, and the two of us, our school books together in one bag, our clothes rumpled by sleep, our bare feet moving side by side. In our swinging hands, the handful of rice our mothers rolled into a leaf of the areca palm. Our wide conical hats had long chin straps. In our pockets, a matchbox, a cricket inside. How beautiful, how gentle the days gone by. And yet those days held no future for us. Many years ago. He left our village to join the enemy. I'm sad and I'm angry. I met him. I shot him. The beautiful and loving things gone by could not stop me. His body lay on the dike, no longer the boy I had known. I looked at his face, grieved for the boy I had lost.
The next poem in this extraordinary collection is a real find by Neil, in that it is the only poem, the only piece of writing this person wrote. He was called Ho Thien. He was a soldier in the Viet Cong, and this poem was found on his dead body, the Green Beret.
He was 12 years old, and I do not know his name. The mercenaries took him and his father, whose name I did not know, one morning upon the high plateau. Green Berry looked down on the frail boy with the eyes of a hurt animal and thought, a good fright will make him talk. He commanded, and the father was taken away behind the forest's green wall. Right, kid, tell us where they are. Tell us where, or your father dead. With eyes now bright and filled with horror, the slight boy said nothing. You got 1 minute, kid, said Greenberry. Tell us where or we kill father. And thrust his wristwatch against a face all eyes, the second hand turning, jerking on its way. Okay, boy, 10 seconds to tell us where they are. In the last instant, the silver hand shattered the sky and the forest of trees. Kill the old guy, roared Greenberry, and shots hammered out behind the forest's green wall. And sky and trees and soldiers stood in silence, and the boy cried out. Greenberry stood in silence as the boy crouched down and shook with tears, as children do when their father dies. Christ, said one mercenary to Greenberry. He didn't know a damn thing. We killed the old guy for nothing. So they all went away, Greenberry and his mercenaries. And the boy knew everything. He knew everything about them, the caves, the trails, the hidden places and the names. And in the moment that he cried out, in that same instant, protected by frail tears far stronger than any wall of steel, they passed everywhere, like tigers, across the high plateau.
Extraordinary poem for an anonymous writer, really. On to the Balkans, and a mere 140,000 deaths, what we know it as the Balkans, but they know it as the Yugoslav Wars of Succession. Boris Dezulovic was a journalist. He founded a satirical weekly with the wonderful title The Feral Tribune. And this passage is written in the voice of a Croat soldier using soldier slang at a time when the conduct of Croatian forces was being heavily questioned, following reports that Serbian prisoners were being tortured. There's a reference in the poem to Chetniks, who were right-wing paramilitaries responsible for many atrocities.
Buraya. We stopped by the first tavern along the road and took the table under the red parasol with a Karlovac beer logo on it. We laid down our arms, took off our jackets. We stank of sweat and engine oil. The owner passed the brandy to the liberating army. The waiter asked for our orders. 5 kilos of roast lamb and a crate of beer for starters. "As for this Chetnik here," I said, pulling his head out of the bag I kept beside the chair and putting it in the middle of the table, "a little red wine for him. He looks a bit anemic." The waiter laughed. Everybody laughed. And the owner said, "He'll get it on the house if he asks politely." "Well, he did," I replied. "The last thing he said was, 'For God's sake, please.'"
Still in Croatia, Tatjana Lukic wrote and then emigrated to Australia.
"No, I was not at the square when a grenade hit."
"Yes, someone dear to me was hit there."
"No, I did not sleep in a cellar."
"Yes, I phone every night those who were sleeping there."
"No, I was not a man, and they did not take me to the camp."
"Yes, I met someone coming out of the wires with a bullet in his chest."
"No, I did not see anyone dying."
"Yes, I saw the corpses floating along the river."
"No, I did not starve."
"Yes, I sold a wedding ring and bought bread and milk."
"No, nobody forced me out of my home."
"Yes, someone changed the locks and lay in my bed."
"No, I did not buy a tiny pistol I spotted in the shop."
"Yes, I liked it. It would fit in my wallet."
"No, I did not choose the riverbank I happened to be at."
"Yes, I know I could learn to swim."
"No, I was not scared."
"Yes, I did cry watching the planes passing by."
"No, they did not hear me. I was far below."
"Yes, I knew they would drop a bomb in your backyard."
"In fact, I did not know. I worried they might do that."
"Yes, I remember everything."
"No, it was not cold. It was a beautiful summer. I walked my baby in a stroller and sang to her the whole day." "What did I sing?" "About a cloud and a bird, a wish and a star. La, la, la."
"Yes, nothing else."
"The wretched Iraq has been fought over ever since 1980, almost without cease. In the first Iranian and Iraqi war, which we've now almost forgotten because of the atrocities in recent years, between 200 and 800,000 Iranian forces died and 100,000 to 375,000 Iraqis. And then in the Gulf War, a mere 20 to 35,000 Iraqis died. And in the last 2003 to 2011 Iraq war, 60,000 approximately died. Brian Turner, and it was an American in the US Army for 7 years, including a long period in Iraq. Michael.
"Here, bullet. If a body is what you want, then here is bone and gristle and flesh. Here is the clavicle's snapped wish, the aorta's opened valves, the leap thought makes at the synaptic gap. Here is the adrenaline rush you crave, that inexorable flight, that insane puncture into heat and blood. And I dare you to finish what you've started, because here, bullet, here is where I complete the word you bring hissing through the air. Here is where I moan the barrel's cold esophagus, triggering my tongue's explosives for the rifling I have inside of me, each twist of the round spun deeper. Because here, bullet, here is where the world ends every time."
We haven't heard a lot about the husbands and wives of those who fought. But here is a poem by an American, Jehane Dubrow, whose husband was an officer in the US Navy.
"Against war movies. I see my husband shooting in platoon. And there he is again in MASH. How weird to hear him talk like Hawkeye Pierce. and soon I spot him everywhere, his body smeared with mud, his face blooded. He's now the star of every ship blockade and battle scene, the Fighting 69th, A Bridge Too Far, Three Kings, Das Boot, and Stalag 17. In Stalingrad he's killed, and then he's killed in Midway, and a few good men. He's burned or gassed. He's shot between the eyes, or shoots himself when he comes home again. Each movie is a training exercise, a scenario for how my husband dies.
And we now come up to date with Somalia, Rwanda, the Falklands, Sudan, the Congo, Syria, and most particularly Afghanistan and Pakistan. We simply don't know how many people died in those wars yet. They will compute it, but it is going to be horrific. For reports of which we are indebted to some extraordinarily brave journalists, such as the American Eliza Griswold. Aged only 43, she has, wretched woman, reported from wars in Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. This she wrote from Kirkuk in northern Iraq.
Retreat. The city abandoned. Its citizens fled. A paper chain hung on the wall left standing. A single flip-flop graced the hard-packed floor. The rest diminishes their loss. These were barracks. And yesterday the men tried to blow a hole through me as I squatted up the road and took note of their grim frenzy. Like termites, no, more like tiny sailors from a different time, when war came over water and the battle arrived at a delay. There was nothing to do but watch the enemy grow from blot to galleon, colors nailed to the mast. Like the bright orange flashing, we hung on our car's hood that said to the sky, "Don't bomb us. We're your friends." These others, they had no friends in the sky.
Our last poem brings us back full circle to Wilfred Owen. It's written by a woman called Imtiaz Darkar. She was born in Pakistan in 1954. She grew up as a Muslim Calvinist, in a Lahori household, and she went to live in Glasgow, where she married. This poem relates to the story of Malala and was written in response to Wilfred Owen's, as a response to Wilfred Owen's Anthem for Doomed Youth that Michael read earlier.
A century later, the school bell is a call to battle. Every step to class, a step into the firing line. Here is the target. Fine skin at the temple, cheek still rounded from being 15. Surrendered, surrounded, she takes the bullet in the head and walks on. The missile cuts a pathway in her mind to an orchard in full bloom, a field humming under the sun, its lap open and full of poppies. This girl has won the right to be ordinary. Wear bangles to a wedding. Paint her fingernails. Go to school. Bullet, she says, you are stupid. You have failed. You cannot kill a book or the buzzing in it. A murmur, a swarm. Behind her, one by one, the schoolgirls are standing up to take their places in the front line.
And so we come full circle. As Wilfred Owen said, we have been warned.
Michael, Harriet,